Serious TV Drama Podcast. I am Scott, and joining me once again this evening, the lion to my snake, and the icing on my Orietta prepared cake. It's Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. You know, it's been kind of a boring week, you know.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that, and I have to say, I always look forward to seeing how I'll be introduced, so... Lion's not half bad based on the past, so.
Yeah. It was either lion or bull. I figured I was going to go with one of those. Yeah. All I'm thinking as we're recording this now, and now it's, you know, Sunday night as we customarily record our Fargo podcast, I am just figuratively patting myself on the back for, there's that other series of podcasts I'm doing, the greatest TV drama episodes of all time thing. And I made a conscious decision for the one that we just put out, the one that's on, what was it? Is it number eight? Oh, number 18, an episode of Firefly, out of gas. I had contacted Courtney before we did it. And we recorded that like over a week and a half in advance, or week in advance, I should say. Because I said, I got a feeling next week we're not going to be wanting to record any given night. I think it's going to be a crazy week. And as the way the last week has worked out, there's no way we could have recorded a podcast that week. It just would not have come together. I would have been like talking and then with an eye on the TV on in the other room. And would have went, oh, Atlanta just got 500 more votes or something.
Right. One eye glued to the vote count and trying to do a podcast, not a great combination.
What's John King saying now? Anyway, thankfully... For some folks, we are not here to talk about the election. We are actually here to talk about the latest episode of Fargo. It's the eighth episode of this fourth season, and it was titled The Nadir. I believe that's how you pronounce that word. Once again, well, it was written not just by the team of Scott Wilson and Enzo Maletti. Mr. Hawley also put his name on the written by credits for this, so... He must have worked on it after the fact enough to warrant putting his name on it. So, and I could actually guess a couple moments that he probably wrote. I just had that Hawley feel to it. And it was directed by a fellow named Sylvain White. And I checked out his credits. He's directed a boatload of other TV series over the past several years, including episodes of some of the more notable shows that we like here. You know, at STVD Productions, or whatever we call ourselves here, like The Umbrella Academy, and a couple episodes, I think, of The Americans, and about, you know, a few dozen other shows that do not warrant mention as far as I'm concerned. Before we start talking about the episode, I do want to make one little correction to a mistake I believe I made way back at the very beginning of the season. I believe that I misidentified the actress playing Swanee, and I think I had said that it was Amber Midthunder, who we knew from Legion. Now, I'm not sure how I screwed that up, how I thought it was her. I don't know if I thought it looked like her, because it doesn't really. I thought she just looked a little bit different. I could have sworn I saw her name in the credits. I don't know. And, you know, because I was staring at her in this episode, and I was going, that's not Amber Midthunder. What was I thinking of? And I even went, you know, I ran to IMDb. I was wondering, hey, maybe they recast the role during the COVID layoff, and no one caught on to it. No, I was just wrong. The actress is actually Kelsey Asbill or Asbile. Some folks might know her from the series Yellowstone. I guess she co-stars in that with Kevin Costner. I've not seen the series, but I've heard good things. But, you know, it'll be another one of those series I'll never watch. So I just wanted to get that out of the way first. I wasn't sure if we had mentioned the ghost aspect of the show on the podcast, but I asked you just before we started recording, you said we had, and now I'm thinking we did mention it. Because we mentioned, oh, that might be what was in the coffin in that episode. So just, especially when, with what happens in this episode, I just want to make sure, you know, we're on the record. We're aware of the ghost, you know, but you're right. Because you were talking about a supernatural element. It's all coming back to me now. You know, the chick in Canada who sings, whatever her name is. Anyway, Celine Dion. Anyway.
Well, that was the question when this episode ended that I had in my head was, who was in the coffin? And obviously, based on what's went on at the funeral home, that, you know, I guess the thought is maybe it's the ghost.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with ghost at this point. Now, with this episode, and forgive me if I'm going to be a mite repetitious, and I'll try it. And if you sense I'm doing that, you know, you can cut me. Feel free to cut me to the quick and say, yeah, you've said this before, Scott. So I'm watching this episode through to the end. Now, let me say from the top, I was thoroughly entertained by the episode. I enjoyed a lot of the scenes, you know, certain performances, definitely some of the dialogue, you know, things like that. But, and I think this has been coming up the last few episodes. Maybe we're just becoming more aware of it, or it's more like we were giving the series a reasonable amount of slack or the benefit of the doubt through the first several episodes. But now we're more getting into the home stretch. You know, we're in the final run of episodes, and it's just become clear that the issues that we were trying to like push off to the side initially, it's hard to really ignore them now with the season. And again, I want to be very clear. I still am enjoying the show. I still want to talk about it. There's a lot of fun happening here. Again, it's also a genre and a time period. I love all that stuff to begin with, so I'm always probably going to give it a bit more the benefit of the doubt for myself anyway. But especially after what happened in this episode. But even without, you know, how a certain character met their end and so on, which we'll get to probably sooner than later, I suspect. I kept thinking about, especially after that had happened, I was going, what's wrong with this show? And again, I think we've talked about this, but I was thinking about the previous three seasons and how, you know, I think each season they've gotten exponentially more complex or convoluted, depending which way you want to talk about the show, of course, as far as, you know, the sheer number of characters and storylines and so on and so forth. And it really makes you appreciate, you know, the first and then second season that much more, because the first one is very honed down and they do something very sly in the first season, because it starts out, you know, although you are introduced to the Molly character fairly early on, and by all rights, you should know that she's the protagonist, but you initially might think the character played by Martin Freeman might be your protagonist, but then they do the slight thing of turning who might be the hero into the villain, you know, throughout that series.
Right.
But at least you're rooting for Molly. She's your hero. You know, and to a lesser extent, Colin Hanks as well, you know, kind of Robin to her Batman. I feel like I said that on another podcast. Season two gets more complicated because, you know, you're dealing with this whole family, and then you get the Kirsten Dunst and Clemens duo. And of course you have the Patrick Wilson as your good cop at the core of it all. And once again, he realizes he's your protagonist, because much like the first season, you know, something kind of accidental happens, at least, and we think, oh, you know, but they're kind of innocent. And then you realize, oh, Kirsten Dunst isn't such an innocent after all. In many ways, she's just as bad as the gangsters, quite frankly. And her husband's just along for the ride because he's just trying to do right by his wife. He's a good guy, but he's certainly not the hero of the piece. But Patrick Wilson is. Third season is where it kind of starts to fall apart, because Carrie Coon, we liked her in it, but she was never a very strong character in that series, and we didn't really care about the main Ewan McGregor characters. But at least in the second half of the season, what's the actress's name? I think it's Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Yeah.
She rises from being a very much more minor supporting player in the first half to really taking over a lot of the major heavy lifting in the second half. And then we have, hey, we have someone to root for. We have someone, you know, who's our hero or heroine, if you want to, you know, genderfy it or whatever. This season, it's become increasingly difficult because I hate to boil it down to something so simplistic, and, you know, and the writer in me wants to say, no, who cares about that? You know, you should be able to write about they could be all horrible people. It doesn't matter. But it does. And you've mentioned this a number of times, I remember, that you might have been frustrated that the show starts off where it seems like Ethel Reed is going to play a major part in this. I mean, she was acting as narrator, you know, that first episode or two, and so much seems to be revolving around her. And quite frankly, she's been kind of pushed to the side where she barely or rarely appears at all. I mean, she'd certainly appeared in this episode, and we know what's coming with her, but still. And you have these side stories which feel only tangentially connected to what's going on. So it's kind of like you went from, you know, a juggler with a couple balls to a juggler with multiple balls, and people are throwing him bowling pins, but he's still not able to keep it up. Then the third season, that's going on, but we decide, oh, I'm more interested in the clown that's over there. This one, it's got a whole three-ring circus going on, and I can't decide what I should be focusing on. And as a result, I'm not paying that much attention to any one thing, so I'm not as invested in any one thing, which I think is a problem on the show. Because, I'm sorry, am I supposed to be rooting for Loy Cannon? Is he my protagonist? I don't think so. I really don't feel that. He might be a bit more, quote-unquote, admirable than, say, you know, anyone from the Fada family, but it's kind of sort of splitting hairs to a certain degree at a certain point. I know of the two, he's certainly the one you're more inclined to root for. But I also don't want to make the mistake of tagging him as a good guy either. He's still a criminal who's still going to do bad things. You know, he's just not quite as reprehensible as the other guys. So who did we have left? You have Ethel Reed, who we've hardly seen much at all, and she doesn't really seem to factor into the main story at all, really. And then we had Deffy, who, okay, he seemed to be kind of a side player. We didn't see him all the time, but whenever he was on screen, he certainly took over the screen, quite frankly. And I don't care if we've seen Timothy Olyphant do this before, because if I'm enjoying it, who cares? You know, it's just like seeing Christopher Walken do the same thing in like six or seven different movies. Am I still enjoying it? Do I still look forward to every time he's on screen? Of course. But I feel kind of like they kind of pulled a little bit of a fast one on us, because it seemed like he was going to be a factor with all these stories. We've been watching him watching everybody else. So he was aware of everything that's going on at a certain point. And then what they end up doing, I mean, I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm going to be as inclined to just award points because, oh, that was a shock. Oh, you get points for shocking me. Sometimes I don't want to be shocked, because now I'm like, who am I supposed to care about at this point? I mean, so I'm sorry to go on. I don't know if that qualifies as a diatribe or not. I was trying to be very even-handed about it. But it's kind of bothering me a little bit, just overall. I mean, I don't know what the next few episodes have in store, but this is, what did I say? This is like the eighth episode. We've only got three to go.
Right.
So, I mean, what's your take?
I think the way I see it is this, is in past seasons, like there's been somebody that's a focus. This season, it's spread so evenly that this season is like an album with a bunch of pretty good songs. Mm-hmm. But there's no great song on this album. There's no one character that has gotten enough attention and development that we care about. I mean, if anybody dies on this show, as of yet, I mean, it's good. I mean, it's fun to watch. I look forward to watching it. Mm-hmm. But there are characters in almost any of the past seasons. I mean, I think of the Gerhardts, how much more developed they were because of the time we spent with them. Right. And, you may not have liked them, but you understood them. And what we get is a sprinkle of seasoning. Like we hear Josto talk about, allude to being sexually abused in this. And the characters that probably would somehow be heroic, we leave them alone for long periods of time. Like, for instance, I mean, you know, probably the person maybe we're going to root for the most is Rabbi Milligan.
Right.
And, who we also and he's not seen here for,
what, three episodes now? So,
well, I mean, it seems like that. If not, it detours into this, and you may root for Loy over the Fadas or not, but at the end of the day, I mean, whichever side drops more men, Kansas City's no worse off for whoever is gone. Right. And so it's frustrating from an emotional aspect. The storytelling's good to watch, and I think what robbed us tonight is Swanee and Zelmir have their story, and the way they go out is what you expected.
Right.
And but even that, it's like it cuts, and I appreciate the cut of not dragging out the shooting. But it's, in almost in a funny way, that whole scene is like, you know, an allusion to the untouchable scene with the staircase. And I was watching it when Zelmir looks and sees him, the thing that directs her attention to the staircase is a baby crying.
Yep.
So
it's in fact, they even go, they take it one step further. Cause I was all about talking about the whole untouchables thing. It's one of my favorite movies of the 80s, quite frankly. You hear the baby crying, and then what the noise that follows right after that, it's a porter pushing, you know, a thing of luggage, but it's
right.
But it sounds like the squeaking wheels of a baby carriage. And right. I thought, oh, that's kind of funny. We get two, you know, audio cues that remind us of that. Cause the moment they're in a train station, anyone who's seen that movie, we had referenced that in an earlier podcast that we were kind of expecting or hoping they would do that. You know, keep talking about train stations. Are we going to get an Untouchables moment kind of a thing? I didn't mind the Untouchables thing because they did at least scrupulously avoid doing a direct ripoff of it. They just alluded to it in kind of a sly way, what I just described. So I don't mind that. And, you know, and you're certainly allowed to have big shootouts in train stations. You know, the Untouchables isn't the only one to do that, but you know, it does fit with the whole gangster thing and whatever. In a weird way, cause obviously once the shooting starts, other than the opening few seconds of it, we don't see the carnage as it takes place. It reminds me a little bit of, you got to go back to season one with the Billy Bob Thornton character. When he goes uptown and he goes in that building and you just kind of see like maybe shadows or whatever, the camera just tracks through the windows, but you don't actually see what's happening, but you hear everything. It's almost like a cartoon where you hear people screaming and shooting all the shooting because, okay, you don't need to show us that he just killed probably like 20, 30, 40 people, but it still has the same kind of impact. I think that's what they were going for here. I thought it worked well, reasonably well. I mean, the carnage of just knowing of how many innocent people were killed here is what makes it truly horrific.
Right.
I mean, not that they've been shy on Fargo about going the massacre route. I mean, season two, hello, we were waiting for that for almost two seasons. But they kept referencing that one at the motel, and we certainly saw everyone shot up like no tomorrow in that season. I guess it, but part of the problem with it, I'd said from the get-go, I never really cared about these two. That's why I kept calling them the Bombies, because I just didn't care about them. There was nothing that made me that intrigued by the Outlaws. You know, what Swanee just always seemed a bit too cartoony for my tastes. And it is a show where I feel they can get away. They certainly get away with things that are kind of silly or over the top all the time. I never bought into her character. It just seemed it was just a bit too much.
Right.
You know, and I get it's almost like she's, you know, she's someone who hasn't really matured beyond being a kid who probably went to go see, you know, Western serials, you know, when she was a kid, you know, like 10 years earlier at the movie house. And that's so she can dress up like she's freaking Hopalong Cassidy or something and talk that way and whatever. And she steals candy like a little kid. So I get that about her. I get the broad strokes, but I never cared about her, you know?
Right. And in that, I mean, and I think, you know, the sort of what illustrates our problem is in that sort of scene at the in between Deffy, Otis, and the Bonnies, no matter how it turns out, there's nobody in that scenario we love. Deffy's the closest to that.
Yes.
Because, you know, because of Oliphant's, you know, just his charisma.
You're right. Exactly. We're liking, but not necessarily for the right reason.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, there's allusions to that, but you know, it works and we get little bits and pieces of why we should feel something for Otis, and we do, but then he goes and does this and you know, I don't know. And in that scene, again, we see the ghost. Zelmer's seen the ghost now twice. Right. You know, Swanee saw the ghost and before the shootout started. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. Those two have seen the ghost, that Ethel Rita has seen the ghost. And, you know, Ethel Rita is probably the innocent in all this. And we'll see where that goes. But what I guess she did turn in Orietta, because what Orietta was doing was wrong.
Right.
You know, so, but, I just think it's ambitious, and like we've said before, Noah Hawley takes big swings, and this is a huge chunk of stuff. I may be more generous when I see how it ends, but I just don't see how we're not going to have more feelings like Antoon than not at this point.
Right, I would agree with that. All right, so I'm just going to go through my notes here and try to, like, because there is something I want to get to, and I don't want to be kind of weirdly wedged into the conversation, so I want to come up a little bit more organically. So I'm just flipping through my notes of what actually happened in the episode. You know, cause, again, the stuff with Josto, it's entertaining, it's funny, because it's Schwartzman, so he's still, you know, he's basically a comedic actor, so his scenes that don't involve him, you know, fighting or getting beaten the crap out of by his brother tend to have a bit of a comical air about them. You know, when you start off the episode with him and his fiance and the future father-in-law, but they're intercutting that with those sex shenanigans of Orietta. And even when he's talking to Orietta, as you alluded to, or you know, as you mentioned, he starts to talk about how he starts to talk about the fact he was, like, perhaps sexually molested as a kid. But there's no weight to him saying it. You know, it's because that's the way his performance has been. Again, I enjoy him on the screen, but it's one of those things, wow, a different actor, different way of going about this character, that might have been a bit stronger a moment. Instead, it feels like just a goofy throwaway thing, which that subject matter probably really shouldn't be. And it feels like the only reason I'm even watching that scene is just to see how Orietta reacts. You know, I wrote a joke when I was putting my notes on. Orietta seems disturbed. And oh, by the way, she also seems bothered by the news.
You know? Right. Right. Which in the way that this show has been, I mean, we get sort of a little revelation that Orietta probably was the victim of Munchausen by proxy, that, yes. Her mom gave her the special juice, and she spent a lot of time in hospitals, which probably, you know, led to where she is now. And she got some of that great maternal care from her mother poisoning people. And an interesting piece. And I was curious, just to zoom in on that for a minute. Do you think she was mad at him for what he said when he said, "I love you"? Or do you think she was just more bothered that when he went to the bathroom, she found out Dr. Harvard was still alive? Do you think she really was mad at him, or she was just taking it out on him that she found out Dr. Harvard had survived?
No, I think she was mad at him. I think the moment he started saying anything about the fact he was getting married, she already seemed like she was closing off to him and was kind of getting angry. And whether that be based on some form of morality, or whether it be because she thought maybe this might be something more than what he thinks of it to be, and then for him to then say that he thinks he loves her, she doesn't. How can she take that seriously if, you know, in her mind you're getting married, you know, especially because she may be a maniacal murderess, but she still has a certain pious morality about her as well. So I thought it was more about that. That's the way I took it. Oh, I love
that's
her.
That's how I took it too.
Yeah. By the way, I love the fact she was like channeling, you know, she was doing like a little bit of almost like a Katharine Hepburn or pick whatever, you know, 40s actress, you know, style of speaking, you know, from the movies when she called up to find out about Dr. Harvard. First thing I thought was just Katharine Hepburn for some reason, but, you know,
yeah,
pick whoever you want. But that's the first person that came to my mind. And she also drops a major F-bomb, which I believe is a first for her. I don't think she's used any words like that before. I think she's scolded people for language, if I'm not mistaken. I know Deffy does, but I think she has too. Then you had that whole scene when Josto comes home to find Gaetano there. Gaetano attacks him. You know, it's interesting. He beats the crap out of him, and you're thinking, oh my God, they've all turned on him. Oh, that's where the story is going. I didn't think they were gonna. And then when he keeps repeating the thing, you know, you murdered a child to have me killed. And I picked up like, oh, he's proud of him. And he actually literally says, I'm so proud of you.
Yeah. Basically, I didn't know you had it in you.
Yeah. He finally got his respect, which he certainly did not have before. Gaetano had no respect for Josta before. That's why he was thought he should just, you know, push him aside and take over. Now he respects him. He sees the he sees that he's the snake. He may be the muscle, the bull, but he is the one for the strategy.
And that was a twist that I will admit I didn't see coming, that I enjoyed, that they rejoined themselves, you know, and in many ways it backfired on Loy in a terrible way.
He was trying to tear them apart and said he brought them together. So that was kind of
right.
As I did with my rhyming scheme when I do my notes, poor Loy finds out his ploy didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I did like before they cut the commercial, if I'm not mistaken, when his man, I think it's Opal, says, what do we do now? He says, Fargo.
Right.
It felt like an ad for Fargo by saying it that way.
But I liked it. It was effective. It was effective in that moment.
Yeah.
You know, and many times in this episode, there are things I really enjoyed and liked. And while we started prefacing, you know, that maybe there's not an emotional core in this season. I mean, it's a fun watch. I really look forward to next week. Yep. It's like a really good meal. It's not a great meal, you know?
I mean, I know how I sounded, and that was totally off the cuff, unprepared remarks. And if I was going to play devil's advocate to what I had said, I could also, because obviously we've also spoken about, whenever we've talked about Fargo in this season specifically, we talk about how they're riffing on, either be riffing on or paying homage, or however you want to phrase it, not just Fargo, but it could be any number of other Coen brother movies, right?
Right.
I do feel, to play devil's advocate, it's incumbent on me to say this, that I don't know if I'd say, I don't want to say it's across the board, but the Coen brothers films, quite frankly, are not really known for us developing strong emotional connections to the characters. I'm not saying there aren't exceptions to that. Of course there are. But there are a lot of Coen brothers movies that many people enjoy, including myself. But do we really get strongly emotionally attached to a character? Not necessarily. And again, that may be just my perspective. Someone else might feel differently. Like, you know, you can, didn't they do Raising Arizona? Isn't that the Coen brothers?
Yep.
Love sure Raising is. Arizona. So much fun. So entertaining. Kind of goofy. Do I care that much about the goofball that Nick Cage is and the whole thing? A little bit. But they're so prone to caricature, it's really hard. But at least that when you get a little bit, it becomes more magnified when you get to movies like The Hudsucker Proxy. A lot of fun, very fun movie, very entertaining. But that starts to become more prevalent. Like, I don't know if I really care about anybody in that movie, but I enjoy it. We've mentioned Miller's Crossing a number of times because they're definitely riffing on Miller's Crossing. A lot of fine actors in that movie, whatever. But there is a certain cold, disaffected way that movie has as well. So at least for me personally, I don't get that as emotionally invested in his characters. It just happens, you know, some of the best directors, that is indicative of a lot of their movies. You could say the same thing about Kubrick's movies, for that matter. One could make a case like that for Hitchcock. I would disagree, but I would understand it with some of his films. So that might be could be a defense of his by saying, well, I'm kind of trying to follow the Coen brother blueprint to a certain degree. And that's kind of, you know, indicative of their films. If you think about a lot of the more famous ones. And I said, yeah, but you know what's funny about that? You started this with Fargo. And Fargo is Marge. One of those exceptions. We love Marge. You know,
Marge is the heart of Fargo.
Yeah. So that's kind of what's missing here. It's like, we don't have a heart. You know, I thought we were going to have a heart, but that's the read at the beginning. And I know it was concerning you more than it was me, because I just figured, we'll get to her, whatever. And now I realize it's after 8 episodes and we're still kind of hinting on the edges. And I guess we're worried now that Arietta is going to go after her, especially in that creepy thing when she's staring out the window and the curtain goes in front of her and it's almost like a veil of death or something like that, or a wedding veil. So speaking of Ethel Rita, I think that's what comes up next in the episode, the one interesting way that maybe I'm curious if it'll help tie Ethel Rita in more is that we once again see that she took the ring that was the Don's ring that Arietta had taken as her little murder memento. So I keep thinking that ring is kind of, I mean, it's not, I don't want to call it, it's not really a MacGuffin, but it's like, it's a little thing that's going to, you know, it's going to eventually lead somewhere. If it doesn't,
Chekhov's ring.
Right. Gotcha. And the scene at the funeral parlor or funeral home, whatever we call it's their home, but between Mrs. Cannon and Ethel Rita's mom, I keep forgetting their last name, Smutney, I think.
Smutney.
It's a decent, it's a good scene. They're good actresses. You know, I like the whole, she says from the get, I like that she cuts her off before she could even say anything, that I can't help you out of your situation because I know where this is going to go. And yet the woman still tries to do it anyway. And I don't know if it's going to work or not. The interesting thing was, to just step away from that and get back to Arietta, that she finds out that Harvard, he's not just alive, he's not at the hospital anymore. He got transferred to out of state, in fact. So actually, he's out of her reach. I was a little confused, because maybe I erred myself, I'm not sure, I'm not going to look up what the ingredients are or not, but they mentioned that he went to a hospital specialized in the treatment of poisons, because they discovered strychnine in his system. Strychnine is one of your classic poisons. It's also a really good song, by the way. If you don't know what I'm talking about, kids, just put Strychnine song into YouTube. I'm sure it's there somewhere. It's a good song. But I was going, wait, So I thought she mixed in that self-adhering bandage solution stuff, which I don't think it has strychnine in it. So did I just miss, was that on the table as well, and somehow I just missed it, or was confused?
I didn't see, I didn't pay close attention because that sort of box of the stuff you described, something text was in the
As
forefront.
prominent in the frame, and why else would it be
Yeah.
there? You know, why else would she have a box of self-adhesing? I mean, I know she's a nurse, but that seems to be an odd thing to be, especially on the table when she's doing baking. So again, I don't know if maybe strychnine is would be part of a bandage solution. That doesn't really make sense to me because it wouldn't get into your system, so that doesn't work in my mind. But is around that point. Then later on, that's when she finds that we were waiting for her to find Ethelreda's notebook that she had dropped in the closet. We were just waiting. It's like it's been in there for a few. How many episodes ago did she do that when she was hoping to clean? Wasn't that like the fourth episode of the season or something like
Yeah,
that?
fourth or fifth, so it's been a while.
Yeah. And again, that is one of the problems when you're dealing with so much on the show. We've had to wait that many episodes later for that little thing to drop. So, you know, it's a problem, but whatever. I am enjoying the actress playing Ariette. I think she's a lot of fun. I forget her name. I don't have her name in front of me. It's oh, bad podcaster, horrible podcaster. She's kind of well known now because I know she's in a movie. It's on Netflix. I haven't gotten around to watching yet.
Isn't it? I want to say it's like Jessica Buckley or
I think it's
something like that.
Jesse something. I feel so horrible that I don't know her name off the top of my head. I think it's like Jesse something. I'm gonna look right now. Jesse, you were right. Jesse Buckley. There you go. See, back in the day when I would do podcasts, I'd write down all, I'd have all the cast names and characters in front of me. But with this show and this season, I don't. It's like Game of
Hey,
Thrones. I don't
we're
know.
flying without a net, man. We
That's
go right, we go right after the show so we can get it out to the people.
damn straight. This leads us to one of the scenes I think was probably one of my favorite scenes. It's Steffi going to meet Loy. He has that little interaction with Opal first outside where he go. Steffi can be a bit on the loquacious side at times. Instead of just showing him his badge, he has to go through all that. And he even goes like, do I have to go through all that all over again? And part of him is going, you just like to hear the sound of your own voice. And then the voice in the back of my head, like, sounds familiar, Scott.
And this was the Raylan
Oh my
Givens thing
God.
of all. This whole scene was
Okay.
Raylan Givens.
You can just like pick off each thing, which are like, that's a Raylan, that's a Raylan.
Yeah.
It's the way he's talking to them. That's what he's talking about. And when he starts telling the whole thing about, you know, shall I tell you about the criminal mindset? And he starts, you can imagine that almost being word for word coming out of, you know, Raylan Givens' mouth. And
Right.
then they have a fa then he does a fast draw, which especially in season one, when it seemed like it was going to be more of an episodic drama as opposed to a serialized drama, that was the big thing with Raylan, that he was a throwback to the Wild West where he could pretty much, you know, quick draw, fast draw, whatever the phrase is, anybody around. And that's what this man does to these two guys. And
Right.
I couldn't stop laughing. I was like, he's totally railing now. They're not even trying to hide it. It's just an effort.
Totally railing because Bullock gets mad and loses his cool. Raylan does this and wins the quick draw and this was, but this was beautiful because seeing Rock and Oliphant in that scene together in this scene was really great and had some of the best dialogue of particularly like the line he's like, well, we're pretty friendly. He goes, no, I like you. You're unfriendly. It's the way you're unfriendly. That's why, you know, like you're doing me a favor.
Like you're doing me a favor, right? You know,
You know?
we Mormons are very friendly people.
Yeah.
Pretty unfriendly,
Yeah.
really.
Yeah. Yeah, but then relents. But, you know, there is in his dialogue, he does what Raylan often did, and that is a lot of it's BS and posturing, but it hits at a core that Loy knows ultimately is true, that you can't argue the moral high ground when you gave your kid up, and it strikes at something in Loy.
Yeah, it's a hard point to argue against, because, and when he makes the, I think he said something like, so you're willing to sacrifice your kid, but you're not willing to, you know, give up the information on these two strangers.
Right.
That doesn't even make sense. And it doesn't. He's got a point.
Right. To get the weight of the federal government off your back, you won't do that.
Right. Of course. You know, then that's followed by, we get that scene. I think it's at, oh yeah, it's when, Deffy is pretty much getting the troops ready at the police station, and he has the scene with Otis. And it was at that moment, it's like what you were saying before, we thought, oh, maybe Otis is going to have the redemption that we talked about, possibly, when he, especially because he seems like he's coming clean to Deffy about the type of person he is, and about his nervous tick, everything just culminating in that one little conversation, you know, which pretty much ends with Deffy telling him, you know, you want to die like a man, you got to live like a man, whatever. And of course that, you know, if there was kind of a little bit of subterfuge in the episode, it's like, we get that. And then it turns out not to be the case. But I'm not skipping to that, because then I'm going to skip the thing I wanted to talk about the most in the whole darn episode. Because after that, and we see it's going to be, the next thing is going to be a Union Station, where we think, oh, we're going to get onto it. But then we get Deffy and Otis in the car. And this is my favorite thing in the entire episode. And yes, this is a Scott thing. I don't care if no one else liked it. Screw all you people. There's in this scene in the car, Deffy tells a limerick to Otis as these wise words he once heard. Now, some who know their writing really well, I would not be one of them perhaps, may know this as mostly generally slight paraphrasing, because the first line seems to be different, and you can read five different versions of this thing, and the first line is always a little bit different. You know, either be behold, or, you know, a story of whatever. It's a word for, but beyond that, it's a word for word recitation of something that was written by Dixon Lanier Merritt. It was back in the earlier part of the century. He was a famed newspaperman, a humorist, and a bird expert. But here's the thing, and this might be Hawley being involved in this. Could be one of the two other guys who wrote it. I don't want to take it away from them. I don't think that's how those writers or Hawley knows that limerick. I am 99.8899% sure how they know that limerick, because I know that limerick and I've heard it before, and I'm going to share it with you right now.
A rare old bird is the pelican. His bill holds more than his belly can. He can take in his beak enough food for a week. I'm damned if I know how to helicast.
For anyone who didn't recognize that voice, and if you don't recognize that voice, shame on you, or maybe you're like 20 years old or something, that's Peter Falk. That's from a great, not just a good, a great classic even, episode of Columbo, where throughout the episode he's exchanging limericks with the guy who turns out to be the murderer. That's where I knew that from, because that's where everyone's doing limericks, and then Columbo, you know, he just comes in and he has one, and that's what he says. I'm going to say they got that, they knew that from Columbo. They didn't know it because this guy wrote it back in 1910. I'm sorry. That's where they got, that's what inspired it. I will go to my grave believing that. And that was my favorite thing in the entire episode.
Well, I thought that was really interesting for a number of reasons. And we set up, and I'll back up just a minute to say that all the things Oliphant says, that Deffy says, foreshadow what's coming, because he says in the psalm, like, protect us from your snares. So he's asking for a prayer not to basically walk into a trap. And he says to Otis, when Otis comes up to him, he said, I haven't been fooled since Hitler was given those speeches in beer halls. and immediately gets fooled by Otis.
Right.
If we believe Otis was planning on doing that all along, which I think he was, and I'll go into that later, but then he goes and does that, and because he's never violated his code the whole time, he does the limerick and uses curse words for the first time and goes against his faith. And then finally, what's the thing he says when he gets out of the car, Geronimo, and, you know, the whole time Otis is saying 10 little Indians. I mean, it's like, you know, you couldn't paint a more likely series of clues that something bad was going to happen. But I will say that Oliphant's so charismatic when he walks in leading those cops into the train station. He just looks taller than them. He looks tougher than them. I mean, he's just such a figure that when he reaches his demise, it's probably the saddest I've been on the show, just because I hate to see the actor go, and because he's so great. And but I love that scene. I love the setup. Now, the question I guess I have for you about the episode, did Otis tell him the truth? Was that Loy on the phone? But was Loy telling him to take care of him and he lied about it?
That was my thinking. Although.
But I'm not sure Loy would bring the government down on his head.
I don't think. Let me put it this way. I think he was being honest that it was Loy on the phone. I don't know if Loy would have had him taken out because there's no upshot to it. There's no reason for it at that point. I mean, he's basically told him the information and he said, you know, once you're done, you know, don't cross state lines again. You wouldn't, you know, you won't be safe if you're still here. It may be revealed that he did tell him, and that would make sense. I just felt it was a loose end that Otis had to take care of. And this is the one guy who knows that he's corrupt and he can't be sure that he won't blow him up at some point. But again, I might be being naive on that, and it may very well have been Loy's command. Or maybe I just don't want to believe that Loy would have then turn around and have him whacked. That seems like a fodder move, but it didn't seem like something canon would do. But I could be wrong.
I don't think Loy did tell him to kill him, because I think that you're right that Otis wants him eliminated because he truly knows how corrupt Otis is.
Right.
But also, if he then directs the attention of the government on Loy, then that's a group of people off his back. And the pressure of him being dirty, that almost in a way, if he's ever going to be clean, he has to get both sides of this war off his back.
Right.
And that gets Loy off his back. Plus, you know, Deffy didn't always treat him well and called him a lot of names. Right. And I don't think Loy ordered it.
I already know the answer. I'm trying to be in denial about it. And maybe because of what happened with Dr. Harvard, because for all intents and purposes, when we saw him, you know, bubbling at the mouth and so on, you know, a couple episodes ago, we were pretty sure he was dead. And then it turns out he's not. Was that a dead man stare that Deffy had when Otis looked over at him at that point?
That is how I interpreted it. Now, I will say this. I'm pretty sure Swanee's dead. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
I agree. I'm trying to see if there's any way that possible. I'm pretty sure he is dead.
It is interesting that he raises himself up. When he's shot, he goes down and he raises himself up to stare at Otis.
Yeah. So again, you never know. I would say I'm 95% sure he's dead.
I am too.
But I'm still holding on to 5. Let me put it this way. I think there's a better chance of him turning out to be alive than the election being overturned. Anyway.
I will say this. If we're doing untouchables homages, it would be great if sometime next week he crawls, you know, on his stomach and leaves a huge blood trail somewhere to say, what are you prepared to do? Before he dies, just so we see him one more time. So
you just wanted to get a shout out to the recently passed away Sean Connery.
I did. One of his iconic lines and a great shot scene from a period piece in the scene in the apartment where that goes down. Is an awesome.
Love the Untouchables, and he's fantastic. Everybody's fantastic in that movie. Even Costner's fantastic. That's because that's before anyone really knew who Costner was. I sound like I just knocked Costner. That was a kind of a backhanded comment. I like Kevin Costner. He's fine. But he's a special. I could spend all day talking about that movie. The music.
So good, man. So good.
Anyhow. So then, actually, we're getting towards the end of the episode. We're back with Giusto and Gaetano, and that's when I really enjoy. I'll say, here's the thing. I know I took a lot of swipes at Schwartzman as the Giusto character earlier on in the podcast, and I will stand by them. But, I hit the B really strong on the mic there, didn't I? But the one place where it kind of weirdly works is in many of his interactions with Gaetano. The whole scene where he basically tells him that he sent Calamita after Milligan and a kid. When Gaetano realizes that you told Loy that his kid was dead and he's not, and you don't even know if Milligan might show up there with the kid at any point in time. Gaetano already made it clear how much he respected him earlier. I mean, he basically swore his loyalty to him, you know, on his knees in front of everybody. And he seems to be truly genuine about it now. But I think this just pushed him even further up in his admiration scale, because the balls on this guy is probably what he's thinking. Like, well, those are, because that did take some major fucking balls, because you're taking a massive chance and you just said, fuck it. You are the Python.
Right. And I think it goes along with what I think his realization of what Giusto's become pairs with what we've been saying in past episodes, that you see Giusto not being as comical and being more serious in his role and more thoughtful and more competent. And Giusto's has come into his own in Gaetano's eyes, so much so that when this, you know, the only outright homage to Fargo I caught was obviously this was very reminiscent for me of the season two, like, shootout in the field.
It just wasn't done remotely.
It wasn't as good.
It wasn't.
We have a Kellerman callback here. Mm-hmm. So the funny thing to me is in both, and this is a Fargo thing. So, I mean, you know, I don't want to just unfairly pillory the episode, but, we have two shootouts where, like, neither of the intended targets are killed by a huge group of people attacking them. Mm-hmm. And it's like the red shirts all die or the civilians all die. And you know, I guess the big point is there's collateral damage,
right?
To their mother, which will obviously means now the cannons and the Fadas there can be no peace now. Like, you know, if all those guys at the fire pit died, maybe they could work something out, but probably not. But definitely now that the mom's dead, there's no way they could work anything out.
Right. Absolutely.
It's all out war.
And
families. And the point is now families are fair game.
Right. I will also point out we spent next to no time with their mother to really have any feeling about her either, which is also a little problematic. I wish they had more scenes with that character.
But we know she wants her boys to come in out of the cold. We know that, Scott.
I mean, I know. I literally was like, when we saw her, I was like, have I seen their mother before? And I realized, I believe I had, but it was brief. Like when they had like the big family dinner thing with the seat thing, but hardly at all. And who the other woman? I don't know. Is that a sister? Is that someone else? Is that the one we saw before? Who was that? Altoon's wife, who's still there? Maybe. I don't know. They're just.
Yeah, I think that's Altoon's wife that was raising the kids.
All right, so okay, got rid of both. And their kids will probably turn out to be someone who was in an earlier season or something. I don't know. And yeah, that's actually the end of the episode. So there you go. So I mean, again. I enjoyed it. I mean, I did go, no. Actually, I was doing like the Letterkenny notes, like, no. when Otis went bad, or, well, he was already bad. What did I write in my notes? Because I didn't write anything about that scene other than I wrote, God damn it, Otis. That's what I wrote. Which is kind of how I felt. And I kept going, oh, gosh, I hope he's still like, even if there's not much original about his character, he's just so much fun to watch, but whatever. I was able to leave it on and watch the little preview or trailer for the next episode. Now, I don't know if they just decided to show it this way for the trailer or if this is what they're actually going to do. I'm very curious. The trailer made it seem like they're going to show the next episode in black and white.
That's what it looked like to me. I watched it too. And it looks like the whole, at least some significant part of it's in black and white.
Yeah. So I am all about the black and white, you know, that already for some reason, especially when you're dealing with, you know, it's a period piece and gangsters, whatever. I could have done the whole season in black and white for all I care. You know, I love the gleam of automobiles in black and white. It would have been beautiful. But, again, I enjoyed it. I was entertained by it, but as I said from the get-go, and I'll end by saying it the same thing. I am continuing to be entertained by the show, but I do have the realization with each passing episode what's missing or what's wrong with this season. That, you know, I mean, I still think odds are good that I might still like this one better than season 3, but I'm not sure, because there are certain things I really loved about season 3 as much as I didn't like everything with the McGregors. You know, you and McGregor, the twins, whatever, you know what I mean.
I just
drew a blank on what the character last names were, but you know we all know what I'm talking about. But I'm not sure about that, because then I keep thinking, oh, but the Mary Elizabeth Winstead stuff with the deaf guy and all the stuff with Stolberg. There's a lot of fun stuff in that season too. So we'll see. Curious.
Now what's curious is, based on the preview we've seen, is if we branch off and follow Rabbi Milligan and Satchel for a whole episode, you know, that's going to be another diversion, that getting back to this story, we're going to get pulled out of it. And so I'm curious. I mean, it's a story I want to see. Like I've said, I think right now Rabbi Milligan's probably the closest thing we have to an emotional core because of what he's been through, and he's saving the kid.
And circling back to what I said earlier, I mean, he would totally could qualify as being that quote unquote, that protagonist, one we root for, one we might be emotionally attached to, et cetera, because we know what he's been through and what he's doing and has been doing is heroic compared to what almost anyone else is doing outside of Arietta writing a letter, not Arietta, Ethelreda writing a letter. But the problem again is you've disappeared for a few episodes. Kind of hard, and again, it's because you're juggling so many different things. You know, one of those things like, hey, you know, if you cut this down a bit, and thus made it maybe even a tighter season. I'm a little worried that they've added an episode, and it sounds like as you were saying in a previous podcast, a lot of that might have been based on just recutting things to almost like shape another episode. It's like, well, that just tells me you've got way too many pieces on the board here. So you know, you can just keep wiping people out and be like, all right, okay. Oh no, you killed Lemuel. All right. Oh no, Opal's dead. Oh, okay. Oh, Calamita we hate, so we will be. We'll be happy when he dies, but watch. And as you joked, he'll be the one guy who fucking survives.
Exactly. It may be, but just a couple. I'll finish up with a couple of random thoughts, since sure. You can call this Brian's Jazz Corner, because they've talked about jazz.
Yes, they did.
Let's see, when they're in Ethel Rita's room. Is the son's name Lemuel?
Lemuel, yeah.
That the horn player talks about Charlie Parker blowing up, and Charlie Parker actually did sort of come out of being a sideman into his own around this time period. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, something pretty accurate. I thought that was interesting to. You know, there are touches and there are things this show does really well like that, that if you look into it, it is interesting to add these little flourishes, that there's a son who's really into jazz and they nail it and they get, cause Charlie Parker was playing with Dizzy Gillespie then. And around that time they released one of the most important jazz records called Diz and Bird, which is a, you know, a big, big record and formed sort of the basis of bebop that became Miles Davis and all this important music later.
The kind of details that Fargo can pack into any one season of any season will never be one of the flaws of the show. It's always going to be one of those nice little nuggets of that you'll find in episodes, like several other series that we're big fans of, whether it be something like Fargo or The Americans or Mad Men. All those shows really have a nice way of doing that, especially when they take place in a different time period. So yeah, absolutely.
And the song, you know, one of the, I think the pretense that Orietta can have to go back to the funeral home is she let Orietta borrow that record that she's playing in her room. That's and right. That was a song. The only reason I know this is because I Shazammed it. And it's a song called Le Petit Homme by Edith Piaf.
Piaf. Yep.
And which translates to The Small Man. So I don't know what the lyrics are in English. But that's the song. If you want to look it up, I could have probably looked it up and had that for you if we didn't record right after, but getting this quality content out to you folks.
Actually, what I liked about that scene was, when he asked her favorite jazz player or jazz horn player, whatever. And she says, goes with Louis Armstrong. And he says, oh, everyone says Louis. It reminds me of like, maybe, you know, you can imagine a conversation like 15 years later, who's your favorite band? Like the Beatles. Like everyone says the Beatles. Why wouldn't you know something like
that? Right.
Because Louis Armstrong was that popular at the time, but he wasn't. But you had all these up and coming, and or people who were, you know, again, your Gillespie and Parker, and then, you know, you're a few years out away from like Davis and all those people. Good stuff.
Yeah. Well, the great thing about that is he says, you know, they're breaking the rules, and she says, well, I like the rules. And it reminds me of my favorite jazz joke in anything is in The Office when Angela's sitting on the thing and she says, and what's up with jazz? But just play the right notes. My favorite jazz joke of all time. But
I think there's go on.
No, I was just gonna say, but I mean, I agree to finalize my thoughts. I agree with you. I mean, enjoyable episode. Want to see what happens next week. And hopefully we see what happens with Milligan and the kid.
Satchel. Yeah. Turns out he's a pitcher. No, it's sorry. 1950 is too late for that. Okay. I'll do the wrap up first before I go into other podcast stuff. So if Kids, if you enjoyed this podcast, guess what? You'll enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page and you can join conversations about shows like Fargo. Pretty much any show you want to talk about, you can talk about there. You can find us on Apple Podcasts. That's what used to be iTunes. You can subscribe to our feed there as well as rate and review us. You can also now find us on Stitcher. We haven't gotten one download on that stupid site yet. Anyway, as far as I can tell. If you want to find us there, if you type our whole name and hit enter, you'll find it. You know, if you just type in Serious TV Drama Podcast, it won't automatically pop up because someone's ever clicked on it before, probably. But if you want to be more specific, just to go right to the page, it's, you know, stitcher.com/podcast/the-serious-tv-drama-podcast. What else do we usually say at the end here? Twitter? Is that the only remaining thing? Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter. I know what I forgot. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. It's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. Twitter is usually the last thing I say. I forgot to mention, if you want to check out our entire archive of podcasts, which is now numbering with this one 283, good lord, these damn things, you can go to stvdpodcast.podbean, guess you didn't get that, .com, and that's where you can find all of our podcasts, all the lovely artwork and everything else that goes with it. So that is it for our presentation on Fargo this evening. Now, normally I'd be saying, me and Brian will be back in a week or so from tonight to talk about the next episode of Fargo. And we will be. But it turns out me and Brian are actually going to get together a little sooner than that. Because as I believe I made a reference to earlier, there is another project going on here at the STVD production. Stupid. And I believe everyone, I think you're all listening to it. Or most of you are listening to it. It's been titled The Greatest TV Drama Episodes of All Time. We've already gone through 20 through 18, which was an episode of House, House's Head, which, by the way, is not my favorite episode of that series. And number 19 was Dexter, the season 4 finale, The Getaway. It might be my favorite episode of that series, but I don't really care. And then number 18 was Firefly, the 8th episode. Ignore what it says in IMDb. They're going by the way it aired, and they're idiots. Out of Gas, which is also not my favorite episode of that series. Brian will be joining me for number 17 on the list. And we'll be talking about the rather amazing Mr. Robot episode that came from the 4th and final season of that series. It was titled 407 Proxy Authentication Required. It's nice when it's one of the titles you can actually say, because there's a lot of titles in that series that I wouldn't... if we talk about any of them, and I think we probably will, I'm probably going to be like, the 5th episode from season blah, 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 whatever, as opposed to whatever the titles are, because they're based on different types of coding and so on and so forth. I will say right now, that actually is my favorite episode of Mr. Robot. So one of those nice times when, you know, the stars align and the episode chosen as the best episode is actually my favorite episode of that series. It's probably only going to happen a few times in the countdown from what I can see. This will be one of them. So I know we're looking forward to talking about that. We'll be recording that this week to be delivered to your earbuds on Friday, the whatever date Friday is. I can't think of off the top of my head. The 12th? 12th, I think, right? Wait.
Sure.
Yeah, well, who cares? 9, 10, 11, 12. No, the 13th. Oh, my God, it can't be the 13th. Whatever, the Friday. Anyway.
So, well, I will say, just so the fans know, that when you approached me and said it would be Mr. Robot, because you don't reveal in advance to us either, that would be the series, you see, and I guessed which one it was.
You did. Yes, you did.
Because I thought if I had to pick one of that show, which you and I both stuck with and loved, that I guessed it right away. So I'm looking forward to talk about it.
Yeah, all the kudos. Yes. Not only am I not revealing to you guys out there what the next ones are until, you know, the weekend previous to the podcast. I usually wait until like a week or two before every co-host I've signed up for the entire countdown, and I've got about half of them signed up already at this point. I've not, generally speaking, I have not told the person what the episode is. I'll tell them when it's within a week or two to go, or if they insist. If they insist, I'll tell them. But I like the idea of keeping a mystery from the co-host because, you know, I'm a dick that way. so that's about it. Finishing up, obviously, we've all had a kind of a crazy week with what's been going on with the election. It was very sad that Alex Trebek passed away. So for fellow Jeopardy fans, that was something sad to see. But there's one other thing I wanted to make a special note of before I say goodnight and let you have, it's my new thing. Oh, let you have the last word because I don't know how to end the podcast, apparently. I want to say happy birthday to someone. It's like I'm Phil Rizzuto here. Two people are going to get that joke. November 8th turned out to be the actor Norman Lloyd's 106th birthday. 106. Still alive. You know, take that, Kirk Douglas. You know, well, you're dead now anyway. But and if you know something about classic cinema, then you should know who Norman Lloyd is. Norman Lloyd worked with Hitchcock, with Orson Welles. He's one of the bad guys in the movie Saboteur, which I love the movie Saboteur. Or maybe you know him, you know, fast forward multiple decades. He was one of the main older doctors in Saint Elsewhere. He's been in a billion things. He's an amazingly accomplished person. And he's a Mercury Theater player. I mentioned Orson Welles already. And this man is still alive. And, you know, still in possession. As far as I can tell from what I've read, still seems to be in possession of his faculties. So just wanted to for any other classic cinema fans out there, raise a glass. Yeah, I was actually drinking tonight. To Norman Lloyd. So happy birthday, Norman. So good night, Brian. Thanks again for joining me. And good night to all you out there. And Brian, I'll let you have the last word.
Well, happy birthday to Mr. Lloyd. And everybody have a good week. Decompress from the stressful time we've been through. And we look forward to talking to you on Friday. Good night.